More variety.
You're listening to Para X.
Merry meet and merry parts, bright the cheeks and warm the heart. For tread the circle thrice about to keep unwelcome spirits out. Bide within the law you must, in perfect love and perfect trust. Mind the threefold laws you should, three times bad and three times good. These eight words the reed fulfill, and ye harm none, do what ye will.
Welcome to Stirring the Cauldron. Now, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Hey, merry meet everybody, and welcome to Stirring the Cauldron here on the Para X Radio Network. Many of you will know my guest tonight, Nancy Duterte. Oh, I knew I was going to blow this one. Tertra, from her show, Hot Leads, Cold Cases. Nancy is an attorney and psychic detective, spiritual medium, medical intuitive, frequent media guest, and paranormal investigator. And she interviews people from all different professions who are trained to explore and uncover the truth about strange, mysterious, or unknown phenomena around the globe. Nancy's also an author and well-known as the Skeptical Psychic. And tonight we'll be talking about her new book, Psychic Intuition, Everything You Ever Wanted to Ask But Were Afraid to Know. Welcome, Nancy.
Thank you so much, Marla.
Your book is fascinating, and there are many things that I've always wanted to ask, and brave soul that I am, I'm not afraid to know.
Yeah, I didn't think you'd be afraid to know.
And I'd like to invite everybody that's listening in to feel free to ask as well. So if anybody has a question and you're in the Para X chat room, please send me a private message and I'll pass it on. And if you're not in the Para X chat room and you want to be, come on over to www.para-x.com and click on the Listen Now link. All right, obvious question. First one, how did the moniker the Skeptical Psychic come to be?
How did it come to be? Well, I mean, it seemed like pretty obvious to me because when I did all of my training, I wasn't, just to, you know, back up a little bit, I wasn't born psychic, at least as far as I knew. I didn't, you know, grow up seeing spirits. I couldn't predict the future. I didn't see auras, nothing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what I had, who I am today was really the result of many, many, many years of training. But in the course of all my training, I would argue with all my teachers and I'd say, you know, that can't be right. Or if I got something, if I got an answer correct, I'd say, oh, well, that was luck or coincidence, or, you know, I'm a good guesser. And I would argue with everybody. I was very skeptical. But I figured, you know, that's a good thing. You should be skeptical, you know, because if you jump too far over into automatically believing things, then you risk not finding the truth.
Right. Right.
I've almost gotten into fistfights over the name, the Skeptical Psychic. I've had professors get completely ballistic on me because they said, how dare you call yourself a skeptic? You know, you're obviously a believer. I said, you know, I have a very clear definition for myself for skeptical. It means you keep an open mind and you don't automatically dismiss things that you don't believe in.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a big difference between skepticism and cynicism. And, you know, if you're a cynic, it doesn't matter. You can stand on your head for days and never convince, you know, them of anything. But I think being skeptical is healthy and necessary because, as you said, it opens the door to more truths.
Yeah, and I think a lot of, you know, scientists especially, they don't even, it's like they don't realize they're wearing these rose-colored glasses of skepticism. They don't even see it. They don't realize that they've automatically eliminated whole entire possibilities, you know, or phenomena.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I'm going to jump back just a little bit because you said you weren't born psychic, but what factors led to the interest in the psychic world?
Well, let me put it this way. When I was a practicing attorney in Manhattan, I got invited to attend this, it was a seminar, a workshop seminar for psychotherapists. I was the only non-psychotherapist there. Mm-hmm. And I had an experience there that ended up, it was a full-blown mediumship experience. And it was the days before all of the TV mediums. I didn't know what mediums did. I didn't study them. I wasn't interested in them. And nobody in my family was psychic. So I only realized it in retrospect. And at that point, I thought, oh, you know, there's something weird going on. I don't know what it is. And I didn't get reinterested until I was actually trying to help one of my mentors, who is a psychologist, and he was supposed to be working on a book on intuition. And I thought, oh, you know, I'll help him write this book on intuition. He didn't do it for a very long time, so I thought, oh, I'm going to have to do it. But it was in that process that I got really interested. And when I realized that the psychologists and the scientists, the neuroscientists, none of them were really interested in intuition, which I thought was really bizarre, mm-hmm. Started speaking with psychics, mediums, medical intuitives, you know, you name it. The world was, it got crazier and crazier the more people I was speaking with. And then I decided to train in it. So that's what I did. I trained as a psychic detective for about 10 years.
Mm-hmm. And that's a fascinating subject, which we'll get into a little bit later. But I want to talk about the fact that you believe that everybody has the capacity to tune into the supernatural. And the way to do that is to unlearn our logical thought processes and learn to trust the irrational processes of our minds and admit that, you know, you've spent a whole lifetime trying to do this strange balancing act, as you refer to it. Now, see, I was born into it, yet I've always been a skeptic. And thankfully, it's not something I've had to work at. I always say that my world isn't black or white. I live in the gray where all things are possible and nothing is carved in stone. How do you teach that delicate balance to others who look at things purely as black and white?
I love the fact that you live in the grays. I think that's beautiful. I wish people would do that. I think most people are really uncomfortable if they can't get an absolute answer, you know, a black or a white, and, you know, be done with it. I think it's kind of upsetting for people to live in ambiguity. I do believe that everybody is born psychic. I assume that I was too. I didn't recognize it, and it absolutely wasn't developed. And I grew up in a really academic family. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what they valued was a logical brain. And what I think happens, you know how they say that most kids who are obviously psychic, you know, they demonstrate it really strongly between the ages of 3 and 6, and then it sort of disappears. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then there are a few lucky people like you, I guess, who, you know, you manage somehow to hold on to it. But I think there are many other things that disappear during that kind of window of opportunity. That's the age when we have our best ability to learn other languages.
Right.
That's the age where it's been said that we all have perfect pitch. Most of us lose that too. Psychic ability. I mean, there are a bunch of things that it's almost like we are an endless, you know, we're like sponges at that age, and it gets shut down because we start to learn how to communicate and to talk. And once you start putting things in words, you've set up a structure in the brain. You have to start at the beginning and then you got to follow it logically. So so your sentence makes sense. Mm-hmm. And do that, you're completely out of that, holistic, right-brained, spatial type of thinking. You're into a completely different format. Mm-hmm. And then you get stuck there.
Yeah, and I think also with kids, it's the environment that they grow up in. You know, how many kids here, there are no such things as ghosts, there's no such things as witches, you know, everything you see on Halloween is just all fake. And that, you know, at that age, you listen to your parents, you trust your parents, they know everything. And so by the time you get to the age of reason, after you've been told over and over again that there's no such thing as this or that or whatever, sometimes it is too late. Sometimes you do lose it. I was lucky. I was brought up in a family that believed in all of that and embraced it. You know, it was just another facet of life, if you will. And so that's why I guess I didn't, you know, put up the walls either. But I think things are changing a little bit now. More people are into the more possibilities and things. But most kids just, you know, they open up and then they get shut down, not by them, but by listening to the elders, in a sense. And I think that's kind of tough sometimes.
Yeah, and I think also if you, you know, I talk in my book also a lot about the imagination. And if you come from this intellectual type of point of view, the imagination, you dismiss it all the time. Oh, that's just your imagination. You know, oh, that's a nothing.
Right.
That's what I've tried to explain. I mean, I have a whole different theory on the imagination. I really think it's the place where the brain processes all tons of sensory information that we get that's really subtle. It's not necessarily coming in through our normal five senses, but it's getting to us. It's all this vibrational data that comes to our body, and we're not aware of it. In fact, there. For every second of our existence, we are bombarded with 11 billion bits of information, but we're only conscious of 16.
Wow.
Which is amazing. Which means we have access to all this information. It actually got to us, but we don't know that it's there. And I do think that a lot of it filters up into our brain, and it goes into what we call our imagination, but it doesn't get sort of corroborated by other physical evidence. So we say, oh, well, that was just, you know, my silly little thought. You know, that was just a little fantasy. And in fact, when you train how to do this, you learn to really accept your imagination and accept those kind of strange thoughts that go wandering through your brain. And if you start to look for feedback on them, you'll get confirmations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, you advocate an approach to psychic ability that combines intuitive imagining or imaging with rational feedback, which you call TSP. So what exactly is TSP?
It's my way of proposing that every psychic impression that you get needs to be tested. You've got to be getting feedback or confirmation on it, because if you don't, it stays in that limbo land of, you know, maybe it was a personal thought or experience, and it wasn't something that corresponds to something out there, you know, in reality. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have problems doing that, because sometimes, you know, if you're clairvoyant, for example, the thing that you're seeing might not exist for another 7 years, or it might be happening, but it's happening on the other side of the planet, and who's over there to confirm it for you? So, you know, sometimes it's kind of difficult getting the feedback on it, but it's the tested part of it that you have to continuously be doing. And I don't know that anybody should really stop doing that. I'm not even sure that if you get to a certain level of psychic ability, you may have a sense. I don't know about you, but some of my senses come through really strong, and then some come through really, really weak.
Right.
And and even though I get better and better, I think, all the time, I haven't stopped, you know, testing every impression. That's what I do.
Mm-hmm. And it's something that I think everybody needs to do. Now, you were talking about where things just keep floating around in our heads and work out as imagination. What's the difference between imagination and subconscious?
think subconscious refers to a level of awareness. And I think imagination refers to the content.
Okay.
I don't know if that makes any sense to you, but that's
no. It does. It's just, you know, some people say, well, that, you know, dreams, for example, you know, I had this dream about such and such and such and such. That was probably something floating around subconscious because it was germane to something they either saw during the day or heard about last week or something. As opposed to having a dream, you know, that's pure imagination in the sense that, you know, you're off in fairyland or something, which to witches, that's not really imagination. Let me rephrase that. But you know what I'm saying.
I understand what you're saying. I think, if you're talking about stuff that comes in kind of subliminally, like you weren't really aware of it and you got information somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're talking about when you mean subconscious?
Yeah. Yeah.
And
some stuff floats around in there.
I used to really worry about that. You know, I didn't know. I figured, you know, when people talk about psychic, oh, it must be that pure, you know, no information, no nothing, and, you know, pull a rabbit out of a hat. That's what I thought that was. And what I realized since then is, no, that's not psychic. And most people don't even know what psychic means. It's not what they think it means. For me, anyway, psychic ability, psychic sensing is a type of intuition. And the way that I describe it is you got, you know, on the really conservative end, you got educated guesses, which most people can identify with. They don't mind that. Even the scientists don't mind that. They're missing maybe a couple pieces of information, but they're willing to kind of make a good guess based on a trend of all the other information they have. You have kind of in the middle, most people accept, you know, gut feelings, hunches, you know, something, sometimes sort of physical, emotional butterflies in the stomach, you know, sensations.
Mm-hmm.
And then they make interpretations about what they mean. Then you get really far over on the more liberal end and you get into psychic ability or phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
And that involves, as far as I'm concerned, little to no rationality to it. It can come in as pure nonsense. Okay, that's really good if it does, actually. And a much lower threshold of conscious awareness.
Mm-hmm.
The highest level of conscious awareness way at the other end of the scale with educated guesses, because you're thinking. When you're doing psychic stuff, you don't want to be thinking, and you really don't want to be feeling either. You want to be sensing.
Mm-hmm. And trusting those feelings and senses that you get without question.
Yeah, for me, that was the hardest part.
Yeah, I know. Well, you do that. I mean, you know, they always say, like, when you get messages from your guides, for example, the first thing you hear is what you go with, not, okay, I heard that, but that sounds a little odd. Maybe I need to rethink this and see if I understood it correctly. No, just go with what you hear kind of thing. And that is difficult. And, you know, one of the chapters in your book kind of really fascinated me, and that was that the sixth sense is a myth. Now, not so much the sixth sense part being a myth, but the fact that we seem to have many, many more senses than that. I mean, just how sensible are we really, and where does the mythology enter into it then?
Yeah, I think it's kind of ridiculous that we talk about having a sixth sense because we already know, the scientists have already established that we have way more than five senses. In fact, many researchers have proposed that we have at least 40 senses. And what I explain is if you really go into, you start studying different disorders in neuroscience, the lack of an ability to me, like there's, I think one of them, you know, I don't remember them off the top of my head. I think one was amusia or the inability to appreciate music.
Mm.
You know, if you lose the ability, it must mean at some point there was an ability. And what is that ability? Well, to me, that's some kind of a sense. So we could have, I think we will be discovering tons and tons of additional senses, maybe thousands of them.
Mm-hmm.
in the near future. I don't think that that's unreasonable at all. So when you talk about a sixth sense for psychic ability, it seems kind of simplistic to me. It doesn't even seem...
Yeah, because it is something there. And it's like, I mean, maybe if people want to look at it on, in the broad spectrum, let's say there are five major senses and then, you know, offshoots and branches of those, maybe.
Yeah, and by the way, they also overlap. So, you know, for example, if you're tasting something, some food or something in your mouth, you are smelling it, tasting it, and you're also, you're touching it. So you got three different senses involved. Mm-hmm. So which one is it?
Exactly.
And that
makes a great deal of sense.
That happens with a lot of our senses. You know, if you're listening to really loud music, mm-hmm. you know, you're feeling the vibrations, you know, around the room, and you're also hearing it because we overlap on our different electromagnetic spectrum or spectra.
I think so, we focus maybe just on the main one and kind of let the other ones float away, you know, because we're taught that we only have five, right? So we can't possibly be acknowledging the other ones when we're eating. That has to be taste, kind of thing.
Exactly. And same thing happens. That's why all of this, these really subtle psychic impressions, they get kicked out because our five senses are so strong. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones that we pay attention to. You know, I give an example in my book of, it was an early class that I was doing in psychic detective work. And we were handed a folded piece of paper, so we couldn't see anything. And we were asked, okay, what are your impressions? And we weren't told, nothing. That was it. What are your impressions? This is a case. Okay. So I come up with a bunch of impressions, which turned out, by the way, to be accurate. I had, in my mind, for some reason, pictured the location of where a particular a body of somebody was found. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was so careful, I mean, because I hate being wrong. I get really embarrassed about being wrong if I suggest something, which I think comes from that place, you know, my imagination. So I waited until the end of the workshop, and then I went up to my teacher afterwards, a well-known psychic detective, and I said, you know, can I ask you a question? Did he get shot in his right, no, it was his left temple? And she said, oh, yes, he did. And it was like, oh, yes, of course. And I thought, wow, because in tracking that in my own, you know, scenario of how did I get that information? Mm-hmm. I felt a little itty bitty, like a little puff, like a little tiny puff of air on my left temple. Mm-hmm. And the way that my brain interpreted that was, oh, the guy must have gotten shot. Mm. Normally, I never would have paid attention to that because we don't pay attention to little, they're really subtle little sensations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what needs to be developed. And we don't, you know, again, as we were talking about earlier, we don't trust ourselves. I was doing a reading on a woman one time, and it was just a general reading, but she had a couple specific questions that we were focusing on. And all of a sudden, in my head, I see a pink birthday cake. And I'm thinking, oh, God, is my sweet tooth acting up again or what? You know, but it was there so strong, and I was going to dismiss it. I wasn't even going to bring it up because I thought, oh, this woman's going to think I'm nuts. But something told me, you know, grow up, put on your big girl pants, bring it up. Right. And when I did, the woman broke down and started crying, but not seriously horrible crying, but she said, you know, because I said, does a pink birthday cake mean anything to you? And I kind of almost apologized for asking. And she said, yes, it does. She says, every year my dad used to buy me a pink birthday cake for my birthday. And today is when the anniversary of his death.
Oh, wow.
You know, and that taught me a really major lesson that don't dismiss anything because you don't understand it. you know. And don't feel bad if you're wrong, but most of the time we won't be. Because it may sound really dumb to us or just way off the path, but it's coming out for a reason. And so it's like, don't second guess. And I mean, nobody's 100% perfect. Everybody's going to be wrong once in a while. But that was just, that was a good life lesson for me, you know, to just really pay attention to something that's either minor or doesn't make any sense at all.
I think that's really key. And I mean, that's what's why scientists don't get this stuff, is because they are always in control of their own information. And the whole point of doing this kind of work is, no, this information is not yours. Mm-hmm. Half the time, more than half the time, it actually belongs to somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's absolutely true. So how do the physical senses and psychic senses differ? And while that may be sounding like the dumbest question you've ever been asked, because it's probably obvious to some, I think where I'm going with this is that oftentimes psychic senses become physical. Those of us who knowingly have the ability to hear, see, smell, and feel things that are, for lack of a better term, not really there. You know, like clairaudio, clairsentient. You know, I've been touched on investigations, but I didn't see who it was. So that's psychic versus physical. How do you think that?
It took me a really long time to understand, especially clairsentience or people who are empaths, because they were getting information physically through their bodies. And I just, you know, I tend to be more clairvoyant. And I got some clairaudience tossed in there. But, you know, to me, that can still stay kind of in your head a lot of the time. But this stuff in the body, I didn't understand it at all. Yes. And it's been a matter of my kind of staying open to the idea and training. I mean, one of my first, I think, experiences with that was I was working on a missing person case. It turned out to be a suicide. And as I was talking to the person who was telling me about this this particular missing person, I realized that I was starting to gasp for breath. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, I must be, you know, nervous about doing this because I really hadn't done it that much at the time. And particularly not with something that serious. And I thought, oh, that must be my little psychological reaction. But I realized it was like a kind of gasping that when I'm nervous, I don't do that kind of gasping. And as soon as I did that, I zoomed into it was like a clairvoyant vision. Mm-hmm. I was up above and I was looking down on a car and I realized this guy had blown his brains out inside the car. Mm. But what tipped me off before I went into that visual was the fact that because I was gasping, I thought, oh, I must be linking with his spirit and probably his last few seconds. Mm-hmm. So that to me was like a big revelation. So yeah, they do overlap. There are times, I mean, I have now finally seeing spirits with my eyes, mm-hmm. whereas before I could see them, but I would see them with my third eye.
Right.
I'd have to verify it, you know, later with other information, say, oh, yeah, yeah, that was, you know, historically that person looked like that or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, it goes in and out. It's not really clearly definable. The way that I try to explain this to people is that, for example, I'm really, really nearsighted. What I see 20 feet away is the equivalent of what somebody else will see 2 football fields away. Mm-hmm. So my eyes are really bad. Mm-hmm. If I look at something, if I'm looking at a house, you know, that's a half a mile away, it's going to be really, really blurry to me. To somebody else, it's going to be really clear. Does that mean that we've seen 2 different things or that what they see doesn't exist? Not at all. We right. just have a different lens, we're just perceiving it, you know, with different abilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we all have strengths and weaknesses. And you know, I at one point was in a cemetery and I leaned up against a tombstone. There were other people around. We were talking and it was, you know, one of those hot days that you just kind of lean a little bit. And all of a sudden I started getting chest pain and shortness of breath. And I thought, oh, God, this heat's really getting to me. And then all of a sudden something kicked in my brain and said, step away from the tombstone. And I did. And it went right away. And I thought, oh, wow. You know, I mean, it's all these little awakenings that we have.
Yeah.
That kind of bring about a better understanding. And then we know what to look for the next time or to open up a little bit more to it. Now, how do you think our brains pick up psychic information as opposed to regular information?
For me, I can only speak for myself, and I think that it's a matter of tuning into it. You have to stay open to the possibility that it might be something. Mm-hmm. Because if you automatically shut it down and say, well, there's nothing there, it won't be there. So and that's that living in the grays that you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
People don't like that because people like, you know, things to be nice and tidy and, you know, they like clear things. But if you stay in a state of open-mindedness, you're going to be much, much more receptive and you'll start seeing things that you literally never, ever saw before or heard before.
Yes. And I think you'll agree that doesn't necessarily mean staying with your third eye open all the time. You know, that we can have control of. But it's more like keeping the mind open, the thought process is open.
Yeah.
To all possibilities.
I have a lot of conversations with people who are, I'm sure, far more gifted than I, who are students of mine. And a lot of them will come in saying, you know, the equivalent of, oh, I can't close my third eye. Can't shut it down. It's always open. I'm always seeing everything. So a lot of what I do is teach people how to adjust that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, close it when you want to. Open it when you want to. So that, you know, if you're a really good medium and you don't want 15 spirits hanging around at the foot of your bed every night, you set up appointments.
Mm-hmm.
What I do is I'm very clear. Nobody comes in my bedroom. That's right. Just, you can hang out wherever else you like, but not there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think it's healthy to leave it open all the time. As you say, you could go nuts. You know, it's like being on call 24/7. Because whether the eye is open or not, those of us that can pick up that stuff have this like neon sign above our heads that attracts them anyway. So we need, you know, instead of the arrow pointing down, sometimes we need to put up the close sign, and there's nothing wrong with that.
A deep sign.
Yeah, exactly. No vacancy right now. I think it's
her, not me.
But I think a lot of people sometimes keep it open, and I've heard that 1,000 times. I can't close it. Well, is it that you can't close it, or don't you want to close it? Because it's a little more exciting when it's open. But do you want to stay up all night? Do you want to, you know, like sometimes I just don't think about it. And then like 5 o'clock this morning, somebody was yelling my name in my ear and woke me up. And it's like, okay, that's my fault. Not blaming you. But, you know, it's like, okay, bad on me because I just should have thought about it at some point. But it's really kind of a strange thing when people say they can't, because there's nothing that you can't do. Some things are more difficult than other things, but sometimes there's that thrill. Oh, I got this, so I'm going to always keep it open. Let's see what I can get. And it's not supposed to work that way. You know, everybody needs some time to themselves, bottom line.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And, you know, it's just how it works. Now, one thing that maybe some of the men that are listening might argue, but in your book, you talk about women's intuition being better than men's. Why is that?
Well, the men can argue all they like, but it's true. As a group, and I'm only talking as a group because obviously, I mean, there's some very talented men out there, very gifted, who have tremendous psychic abilities. But the way that I'm explaining this is that women as a group, if you just stick with the five physical senses, every single one of those categories, women have an expanded, they have more sensory ability, you know, on all ends of the electromagnetic spectrum and their chemical senses. So it's just natural. If, you know, if we can actually perceive more, well, yeah, we know more, and it's going to look psychic to if you don't experience it. I mean, I know that I can, I have a much stronger sense of smell, for example, than my husband does. Women, as a group, they have first men. Well, let me put it this way: men are more often to be colorblind than women.
Right.
There's a group of what they call, most people have three color cones in their eyes and are called trichromatic. There's a group of people who are called tetrachromatic. They've got four cones. And because they have these four color cones in their eyes, they actually see a million more colors than everybody else. Well, there are way, way more women who are tetrachromatic because it's literally something that gets passed on in the genes, and your odds of getting the genes with the additional color cone are much greater if you're a woman. Women, from the time they're babies, they hear literally twice as loudly as male babies. Mm-hmm. You know, you can go through all the senses. It's just incredible. Even, you know, they always say, oh, well, you know, women are kind of wimpy. They're always crying. They have to, you know, talking about the pain. Well, mm-hmm. It turns out that we have literally in some areas of the body, we've got twice as many nerve endings as men. So of course we're going to feel more.
Yeah. I mean, that makes perfect sense. Now with this whole thing about the intuition and opening your mind and women are more intuitive than men, does this have anything to do at all with the left brain, right brain theory?
Well, when you say that, what do you mean by that?
Logical thinking versus, you know, the artistic type, that kind of thing. You know, some people are just guided by logic. Other people are guided by more of a free thinker kind of thing. And then, you know, the left brain is the logical brain and the right brain is... I forget what they call it, but you know, it's not the rigid one, it's the looser one.
I don't really see it that way, because women actually are much more adept with language and word, which is something, it's a left brain function. Mm-hmm. Men tend to be, as a group, for example, you know, better spatially. So, mm-hmm. you know, they are better looking at a roadmap.
Right.
And that's a right brain function. So I never really look at it that way. I mean, there was a thing that went on for many years, and actually I write about it in the book, because Newsweek magazine, you know, heralded this great news. You know, they'd figured out why women were more intuitive than men, as they thought, or researchers at the time thought, that it was the corpus callosum, which connects the two halves, the two spheres of the brain. And it seemed to have more activity and was larger in women. Anyway, that turned out to be all wrong. So that kind of blew that theory out of the water. And a lot of times people say, oh, well, because women have to deal with, you know, the larger, more powerful males. You know, they learn how to be more manipulative. Plus, they got to take care of little babies. They've got to be more empathetic and tuned in and all that kind of stuff. So a lot of people say it's psychological. I don't think it's strictly psychological. I think there's an actual physical basis for this. Mm-hmm. We got more information.
Right. It makes sense. It does. Now, the other thing in the book that kind of made me think really hard, which was really good. I love having to think. I was really interested in your discussion about synesthesia and that, for example, the days of the week seemingly have color associations. So for those who may not know, what is synesthesia and do we all have it?
Well, it's a neurological condition. And when I first started writing the book, nobody knew about it. I mean, I think I ran across one little really obscure scientific article, and now it's become really big. A lot of people do know about it. It's a neurological condition. I think they still don't really know too much about the origins of it. There are a lot of theories about why people experience this. And what happens is it's like a almost like if you get the wires crossed on two different senses. So people who have certain types of synesthesia, for example, might see a sound. So I know, I remember one example, a man who was a synesthete, every time he would listen to his psychotherapist had a voice that he saw as a mustard color yellow. And they'll just see it. You know, they'll see music in colors as it's being played. You know, they'll hear it too. So there are a lot of different theories about what's happening with the brains when this is happening. And it was very radical a long time ago when I think it was Dr. Richard Sidgwick, and I think he first suggested that we might all be slightly synesthetic. Okay. And since then, that's become much more accepted. I mean, especially really creative people like artists and maybe psychics, people who are open to expressing themselves or gaining information about, say, objects or events that go on in their life from several different sensory sources.
And that's living in the gray, believing that Tuesday can be a color, you know? I mean, as opposed to the black and white.
And what I didn't realize at the time was I kept saying, well, you know, what color is Tuesday? What color? What color? And I'm thinking, no, Tuesday doesn't have a color. Everybody knows that, right? As soon as I asked myself the question, well, what color does Tuesday feel like? Boom, there it was. I mean, it's clear as day. It was amazing. I had the whole week full of color, and I had no idea.
See, and Jeff in the chat room just mentioned that Disney's film Fantasia has a segment where music is shown as colors.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, very neat. I really was fascinated with the whole concept, and it made really good sense. I want to talk a little bit about your psychic detective work, and I've got a question from chat from Henry. And he would like to know, how often do the police agencies now believe or listen to a psychic, as opposed to way back when they pooed it all?
You know, coming to this, you know, relatively new, I don't know that I could really tell you what they were doing way back when. Mm-hmm. It was that I was speaking with he's a retired police chief, I think, or police captain, I don't know the difference. And he had gone to some convention of police officers, and it was a big convention. There were several hundred people in the audience. Whoever the speaker was said, okay, so how many of you out there use psychics in your investigations? And virtually every hand in the audience went up, which is kind of interesting. And then he said, okay, and how many of you would admit to it? Maybe two hands. Mm-hmm. You know, that was it. So it's, you know, gauging that as an answer to that question is really hard. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of them are highly intuitive. Mm-hmm. They're relying on a lot of those senses, which kind of even go with, you know, from, you know, the gut feelings. They're actually going into the psychic feelings, but they don't want to admit it. They certainly don't want to say that they're using those abilities in solving crimes because they're afraid of ridicule, you know? Mm-hmm. More of them are open to it now than they used to be, but they are very, very careful, not just because of, you know, what psychic represents, but also I think they're really careful of who they, you know, the credibility of the psychic that they're dealing with, because I think they've gotten burned a whole lot.
Yeah. Well, I've talked to several people that claim to be psychic detectives, and what they say, some of them actually get calls from the different agencies. Some of them say that they get messaged from people that have been the victims, that the victims will come directly to them, and then they will in turn go to the police. That's got to be a little bit harder than having people that you work with and that trust you and come to you, right?
Yeah, and I've had a lot of people come to me with exactly those kinds of situations. You know, say, oh, you know, the spirit of some homicide victim has come to me, and they're telling me that the body is located at, you know, X location in X state. So should I go to the cops? And that's really kind of you have to be really careful doing that.
Yeah.
Suppose you're really good. All of a sudden now you may become implicated in a homicide.
Yes.
So
you don't know too much. How do you know that much? Oh, you must have been there, kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. So either that, or if they don't know you and they don't know why you're, you know, suddenly showing up, they're going to be extremely suspicious. You know, they don't know you. What's your track record? What's your credibility? Who are you?
Mm-hmm.
Why should we go spend a whole lot of money trying to track down a lead that you're giving us?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's better if you can work at building up relationships with law enforcement. You know,
and do you approach them? I mean, how do you choose who you're working with, kind of that you know would call you credible?
I think you've got to go out there. You've got to sort of introduce yourself, first of all. Otherwise, you know, how are they going to know that you exist? You do have to do that. But I think you introduce yourself without saying, oh, and by the way, I've got the answer to, mm-hmm. you know, this crime or that crime.
Right.
And then they come to you.
Yeah, once you have a proven track record, then I guess you're good to go. But it must be difficult in the beginning.
It's a real for the egg thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's got to be. And speaking of that, you talk about a lot of this on your show, different cases and stuff. Where and when can we tune in and listen?
Oh, to my show? It's
yeah.
Oh, you're so nice. Thank you. It's Hot Leads Cases. It's also on Parx. It's also on CBS New Sky Radio. And it's Friday nights from 8 to 9 Eastern time.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, the whole thing is a fascinating topic, and I love the title of the show. I just, okay, I gotta go listen to that. Now, the other thing that I was a little bit curious about was that people may or may not know that you do readings, you offer classes, and you do workshops. What kinds of things are available there?
Well, in terms of, I mean, readings, those, I mean, I do all different types of readings depending on what the person needs, whether it be, you know, straight sort of psychic reading, a mediumship reading, remote viewing, intuitive, energy work. I do all of those, just, you know, sometimes they get jumbled up together and sometimes they're really separate.
Well, it's interesting, though, when you talk about remote viewing, because a lot of people that do readings don't come out and say that's what they're doing. And so I was interested when I was looking at the list of services and stuff that you can do just remote viewing, which is fascinating.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, I mean, I can do that and have done that, for example, for different paranormal investigative groups. I sort of scout out a situation in advance. I do it for people who are, they may have lost something and they're looking for it.
Mm-hmm.
I do it for standard readings. Actually, I don't know. Actually, I don't think I know anybody. I don't know any other psychic who does this, but what I like to do, it's just me, is mm-hmm. to do what I call an advanced reading. Mm-hmm. Every time I do any type of a reading. And so I just like to have the questions or the names or whatever it is, or photograph, whatever they want to give me.
Mm-hmm.
And I do a remote view on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I do my actual reading with them. And it's really pure. That's what I like about it. It's very pure because you're not dealing with, you don't know anything. And the less you know, the better.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You don't want to go in knowing anything because then nothing falls into place where it should. So also, let's talk about the classes and the workshops.
Oh, yeah, the classes and the workshops. Those I've done for many years. I'm actually currently on my summer hiatus, so I'm not doing any right now. But I do them in the New York tri-state area, monthly workshops, and I teach people this sort of what I call a smorgasbord type of approach, which is a little psychic stuff, you know, a little psychometry, a little mediumship, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they're sort of open for people to come in at whatever level they happen to be on. And that seems to have worked out pretty well. I used to think that you had to start kind of like a, you know, regular classroom and start with the real basics. And I don't think so.
No, because I think everybody's on a different level to begin with. And
yeah,
it's hard to just do a regular thing. Everybody, okay, you know, here's 101. Well, some people are ready for, you know, 701 before 101.
Exactly.
Because they're already up that high and may not even know it.
Yeah.
But you can kind of, you know, when you have your students, when you do these classes, you can kind of read them and see what level they're on. And then it's good to kind of put it in their perspective. And everybody needs to learn a little bit about everything. I totally agree with that. But, you know, there is no beginning and there is no end. How profound is that? But it's true. In this kind of learning,
you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's that's just the way it is. So I think that's a very sensible way of doing it.
Yeah.
And so where can people, when are you going to start again? And where can people find out more about the readings and the classes and the workshops?
All that information is on my website, which is theskepticalpsychic.com. So if they go there, they can find out everything. In terms of the workshops, I usually start them up in the fall. I'm a little bit behind schedule just because my book has just hit the market. Literally, it was yesterday. So I'm sort of getting a little bit bombarded with things right now.
Mm-hmm.
I will probably start them up, if not September, which is what I usually do. It'll be October. But all that will be posted on my website.
Okay, and where can people get the book? Obviously, the website is a start, but will it also be out in, you know, Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all of those places?
It is. It's all those places. Actually, right now, this week, as of yesterday, it's in the Barnes & Noble, and it's on Amazon. It's in independent bookstores, so it's out there. It shouldn't be too hard to find.
No, and it shouldn't be overlooked either, guys. It's a really good book. I mean, if you want to sit down and think, and it's not the pedantic kind of thinking that you feel like you're opening a textbook, not at all. It's just interesting. It's fascinating. And, you know, two or three times I'm like, whoa, you know, that kind of thing. Plus, you have exercises in there.
Yeah, just so that it doesn't get, I don't want anyone to get too locked up in their heads.
Exactly. But, I mean, it's, you know, I'm always recommending books, and people think, oh, you're just recommending them because you have those guests on your show. But I want it to be known that if I read a book and I'm not crazy about it, I'm not going to have that guest on my show.
Marla.
It's true. So when I say that, you know, it's a good book for whatever reason, guys, trust me. And again, you know, sometimes you'll open a book and it, you know, it puts you to sleep after 2 minutes because it's so scholastically written, you know, and whatever. But this is just something that's going to make you think. And it's important to open your mind a little bit and think about things and learn new things. So I would suggest, you know, if anybody wants to get in line, go buy a book. It's really, really good. All right. Well, you know what? An hour has gone again, like in the blink of an eye. So, Nancy, I want to thank you so much for popping in tonight. It's, like I said, a fascinating subject, and we've only had time to scratch the surface. So that's where going and getting the book comes in. But
thanks for having me. And it's been great, actually, because we never had a chance to talk, even though we're both part of the Parax network.
Yes. We come from the same litter, but we just haven't rubbed elbows yet. But yeah, so it's great to meet you, even if it was on air. And everybody tune into Nancy's show on Friday nights. And I want to thank everybody for listening in general. And please join me next week when my guest will be author Lamont Wood. And we'll be talking about his book called Out of Place in Time and Space, which deals with inventions, beliefs, and artistic anomalies that were impossibly ahead of their time. So another thought-provoking show, I hope. And until next time, everybody, blessed be and merry meet again. Good night.
This has been another edition of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks. Be sure to tune in next week at the same time for another great guest and more fun. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without permission is strictly prohibited. Copyright 2009. You have been listening to the Para-X Radio Network.